Avi Adoni Dodi. We enter into this study to draw close to you for the sake of holy service and the fulfillment of your will for us and for all of Israel and for this entire planet. Please assist our efforts and guide our understandings. Let us internalize your Torah to the depths of our being so that we become transformed by your will and its truths. Let neither ourselves nor anyone else come into stumbling as a result of this study. Ga'inai v'abita niflaot mitoratecha. Okay, so we are in the last section, really, of the book, besides the epilogue, that is the practical tools for processing shame. And so there were three kind of categories there. One was just attitudinal change to, and read different stories and teaching tales about how shame produced profoundly positive effect and transformation sometimes. And so that possibility needs to be included in our attitude toward shame. Because also our anticipation and our expectations have a dimension of self-fulfilling prophecy to them. So to be able to kind of change attitude or work with attitude is a real thing. And that's the first category. The second category was proactive, kind of preventatives to shame, meaning to the more self-aware we are, the more we can nip things in the bud. And the more also, as something is just appearing, just materializing, it's more amenable to manipulation, so to speak, positively so. And so the proactive practices were really more different kinds of meditation, meditation itself, meditation of paying attention to the negative spaces, like where your mind wanders when you're meditating, and learning from there, you know, kind of catching, making visible in a certain way, because you're meditating and looking in and listening in, you're able to see the oftentimes the spiritually productive thoughts that are happening down there in the subliminal layer of the psyche, and to begin to get a glimpse of what, as I always say, our personal lineage of neuroses happens to be. And so there was meditation in the negative spaces. Then we also, the exercise of a...
What do you mean, meditation in negative spaces?
The spaces where the mind wanders when it's...
When it's shame.
Yeah, no, just when it's trying to meditate. Like meditation is a continuous flow of thought on a particular object or point of focus. So you pick something as your focus and you try to hold your attention there, which you never can succeed at. And so your mind wanders and you come back, wanders and come back. Basic meditation is just that. But it is also, there is another kind of practice of deep, of kind of working with meditation in a different way, which is to pay attention for where your mind does wander. And to see your kind of the spiritually unproductive habits of thought that and residue of kind of childish, unexamined thoughts that really are, because they are subliminal and we're not really aware of them, so they kind of happen below our visual field and they affect the quality of our life and the quality of our mood.
I think that one of the things that you said, one of the many things that you said, but one of the things that stuck with me that I know, but I have to be reminded, that we have to remember that the whole goal of meditating is to be Hashem and it to be for me. And you also said that the ability to, that when we leave, when our thoughts do wander and to come back, that's really the...
Right, and that's, I mean, the focus of it, meditation is a continuous flow of thought on a particular object or point of focus. So what are you going to choose as your focus? So the focus that basically I shared in the class, and that is my own practice, is really the focus that's on the first page of the Mishnah Berurah, which is Shiviti Hashem Negitami, and he brings the Yud Kei Vav Kei with particular nikudot, the nikudot of Chirik, Shva, and comets, and then there's nothing under the final he. And so that creates two syllables, which you shouldn't say out loud, except you can break it. So the first syllable being Yi, and the second syllable being Va, which are the same nikudot of, if it was a Yud Resh Aleph Hey, those same nikudot would spell Yir'ah. And if it was a Sin Amem Chetah Hey, it would spell Simcha. So that meditation, which is pulled from Nistar, from the, like usually there are many different ways and techniques for adding nikudot to Yud Kei Vav Kei. And most of them, you need to know what you're doing. Is that really, am I able to hold the energy that I will be invoking through that meditation? And is it really what's right for me? But that meditation is pulled out of the Nistar, plopped on the page of the Code of Jewish Law of the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah, and is like there and available to all and appropriate for all and maybe even obligatory for all. So, and it's a very, I just have to say, it's an extremely powerful practice that takes minimal effort. You know, it doesn't cost anything. You don't have to get out of bed to do it. You can do it wherever you are, whatever's happening, you can do it. And it really is quietly potent to change the quality of any moment where it is remembered. And so to the meditations, like the meditation is tamid, shiviti Hashem l'niti tamid, and so it's nice to kind of designate certain chunks of time, 20 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever, to just be meditating. But that's really not what it's all about. That is only a good thing because it then creates a habit. It burns a certain habit of focusing on remembering Hashem's name into your nerve net, so that when you then step into life, that you'll remember to go there when you find yourself standing in line or going for a walk or at a red light or whatever. So that's a proactive addressing of shame. It's proactive meaning there's no imminent shame trauma that is like kind of rolling in. You're kind of comfortably in your armchair, just like thinking about life or whatever, thinking about Hashem. And so you choose to use that time to meditate. And the meditations that we looked at are regular meditations, the meditation of the negative spaces, which I just explained. The narcissistic supply inventory, which we talked about last week, which is that narcissistic supply is really every human being needs shelter and food and clothing and narcissistic supply, meaning like just a sense of, I'll read the definition because it's a triggering.
Supposed to give you narcissistic supply if you meditated on Hashem's name? Say you were in a shame.
It's not so much for that, but it will. I mean, it does just quiet meditation anyway, just quiets and stills the. So, let me just read the definition. The concept of narcissistic supply refers to all the things that validate us, that make us feel special, important, good, beautiful, relevant, desirable, admirable, successful, worthy of attention, and significant. Just as we need food, air, water, and shelter, so do we human beings need a staple of narcissistic supply. It's a survival need, no blame. But the inventory is, what do we do? Like there is, how do we go about securing our narcissistic supply? It's a drive, and if you pay attention, you see that you are, you know, there is a there's a subtle effort to gather to to experience narcissistic supply and to have a trusty source of it. And it's really, really, really no shame. But
can you give an example of a narcissistic supply?
Narcissists like just, oh, that was such a good class you gave, or oh, you're such a good mother, or I saw the way you did this and that. Like just all the things that we
focus on that when you're in need of it.
Well, that we look. I mean, narcissistic supply is something we can give to ourselves. We can get it from Hashem, and we can get it from other people. And so it's an inventory is how much my narcissistic supply comes from here, how much from there, how much from there. What do I do to get narcissistic supply? Is there a strain of like kind of generosity and good deeds that I leave behind as I move through life and I legitimately acquire narcissistic supply? Or do I manipulate the world in order to pay attention to me? Do I throw a tantrum? Am I passive aggressive or whatever and try to secure my narcissistic supply that way? And so that's the exercise, is to really honestly evaluate the relationship to narcissistic supply, because that is going to make you, it's going to affect how you relate to shame and your susceptibility to shame. And then the other form of meditation was to look at, like one of the reasons I really wrote the book was because it became clear to me that we're not going to solve the problem of sinah sinam until we learn we become aware of how shame processes through our psyche, circulates through our psyche, and how we deal with it. And so, this third form of meditation is really looking at all the things that irritate us and the aversions and also attractions that we have in our life, and to kind of see what it is that triggers that irritation or that aversion. And like sometimes it's as simple as someone disagreeing with us, and we, you know, it produces an aversion that is fiery. So, but when you're aware of that and you see, oh, you know, that person's allowed to disagree with me. It's inappropriate for me to get so triggered by it. And so to begin to take responsibility for things like that and not keep projecting them onto others. So that meditation of really looking at and unpacking, our aversions and attractions is another journaling meditative process, proactive. And now we're getting to what we did last week was looking at how subtle it is, the way we speak to people, how subtle, how often there is some shaming that we're doing that we almost don't even realize it. And that there is this, if you pay attention, there is this perverse pleasure in kind of in speaking in a way that just, it's almost a disguised shaming. Like we looked at, I had a handout of how the sentence would be in a shaming way, a subtly shaming way, and how it could be restated in a way that was not shaming and should be restated in a way that's not shaming. And it's very interesting. Like we live in a shaming society, really. I think child rearing for so many years, I don't know if it still is, but was often like shaming the child in order to get them to behave. And so that's just kind of a like the cloud that we live in, that we operate in, the sociological cloud, has a lot of that. And so we have habits from our upbringing, shaming habits from our upbringing, where we...
So this day, I have the Oliver Twist picture, and he walks up, and he's scared, and he asks for more. Did you ever see that?
Yeah.
He gets so angry at him. Or, and then what he does, I still have that in my... That's exactly what we're saying.
So it's really, I mean, enlightening, I must say, to just pay attention to how you interact with people and how you, and how there is a subtle, like, kind of a, just prick of shaming that often is hidden in there. Okay, now we're in the nitty-gritty, which is the reactive practices. Like, you're in a shame spasm, you've already gotten triggered, or you're in a situation where someone is in a shame spasm, and how to deal with it.
One of the first reactions sometimes I have when I'm in those situations, not often, yes, but is I want the earth to swallow me up. Like, I want it to disappear. I want to evaporate. I don't want to be there. I don't have a book, Debbie.
Does anyone want a book?
Oh, also? Sure. Do you have a book? Can I see it?
So we're on page...
Yes, I think that's a very important example.
Wait, yeah, say that again because I was distracted.
It's saying that one of the things that when I'm in a shame spasm and this doesn't happen often, but whatever, is that one of my first reactions is I want to evaporate. I literally want to, like, disappear. And that way, I don't have to, that's the first, like, to deal with.
Right.
Second, it's the shame. It's the shame within the shame within the shame that you want to disappear, and, like, you're so, like, little. I literally feel myself being the size of a pea. I feel that. And
it's very hard to undo that.
Right.
But
it's not so bad if you say, I'm in a shame spasm, so I want to disappear. Like, it's different than if you're, like, you know, almost not acknowledging the shame spasm and just wanting to, you know, wanting to disappear. Like, once you get the language of shame spasm, then it becomes kind of a playful, like, awareness that it doesn't grab you in the same way.
You make a mistake. You make your shame coming from making a mistake.
Often, yeah.
And it's like, it was a mistake, and there's nothing I can do to undo it.
Right. But
what can ease it?
Well, Hashem, I get the picture that I'm human and flawed and, you know, not the center of the universe, and so I got the message. Now please help me to figure out how to deal gracefully with this public mistake I just made, or whatever.
Or if someone actually shames you, like says something like you're doing it wrong.
Uh-huh.
Like, for me, my reaction is more like defensiveness. That's like my fight, safety, go. And then sometimes release, like justified anger.
Right. Well, I mean, each situation is different, but I mean, the question is, what is the most spiritually productive way to respond to this? And sometimes it might be anger, you know, I mean, that is an appropriate response sometimes. There are things that are angry making, but the question becomes, is if I act on that anger or if I really just let loose with it, is it going to serve me or not? And that's, I mean, we're going to talk about it more as we go in here. But, you know, I mean, there are anger is Yeah, and the Zohar talks about how anger is kind of the worst of emotions and the best of emotions, that it is all good and blessing, it says, comes from anger. So that's what's it talking about? That's a great question. But we're not going to do that right now. Okay, so what page are we on? 248, yeah. Okay, so the way the class works is that we go around, people read a paragraph, and then the next person reads, and you know, so.
Yeah.
What? What did you say?
Yeah, no, I keep on turning it, and she keeps on trying to
match.
If you read upside down.
I feel like a young
man. The first step is to acknowledge, okay, you find this, a shame spasm is happening. It could be yours, it could be someone else's that you're with. The first step is to acknowledge that we're in a shame spasm and label it. That has several benefits. Over time, we'll start to recognize its early symptoms, and this will enable us to address the problem sooner and thereby spend less time in an unpleasant shame state. Two, the sooner we catch and label shame, the less likely we are to do something rash that we'll regret afterwards. That's one of the main dangers of shame, is the reactivity of it, is that inevitably, whatever you say, you're going to regret it the morning after, type thing.
Well, did we put that in this class that they have dogs, special dogs, that they train for trauma victims? Now, it's more now from the war, but a little bit before, that they could smell the cortisol and they warn the person before they're having a panic attack.
Wow.
And each person, like, they pair up, and then and the dog gets to recognize the person. And
how does the dog warn them?
And they, like, jump up to them. They smell their cortisol levels rising.
Huh.
And then if you catch it a little before and you do all the work, the breathing or whatever, it alleviates the intensity of the panic attack.
Oh, wow.
So they have to.
That is very interesting.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. Who's up?
The second step.
Yeah.
Okay. The second step is to stop, breathe, acknowledge the discomfort, and catalog its symptoms. To note, where is my body? Do I feel the distress? Stomach? Head? How does my body react? Shortened breath? Racing thoughts? Am I sweating? Am I chilled? Breathless? Tense? Has the shame triggered fear? Anger, hate, frustration, self-contempt, what emotions are coming up?
Right. So that's, you know, I mean, it sounds good on paper, but it's really a practice to be able to, like, say, to remind yourself, I'm in a shame spasm, I need to step back, breathe, and just witness what is happening inside my body and my
So what happens is a vicious cycle. When you ask, when a person is in a shame spasm or any traumatic experience, so when you ask, sometimes the first few times before they get to realize, how do you feel or what do you feel? So the answer is, I don't feel anything.
Mm-hmm.
They a lot of times don't have the ability to even feel, even though their heart is beating very, very fast, they don't feel it. It's too scary.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's too scary. So.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a while until certain people, a lot of people, start really, really, like, even if you do about hunger. So if you look about the hunger and eating, so really, well, sometimes the signs we, our brain really feel hungry, but it's not really our body, that we misread the signals. So here also, like, a little pre before, say, because you're also in the same pattern, you're also in the midst of this whole thing. So that's why, and very well put, that you have to practice it. So you have to be able to come do it automatically, almost.
Right. And you might, you know, I mean, it might take some time to even do the first step, stop and breathe. You can't even get to, acknowledge the discomfort, you know, catalog its symptoms. Like, that's a further level of self-awareness. That
many times emergency techs will say that accident victims are not at all aware of where or having been hurt.
Uh-huh.
Because they're such, not so, primarily so, but they are so, exactly, so hyped up on the adrenaline and whatever else fight for survival, that the fact that they've been injured is completely doesn't even register.
Right.
Which is a good thing. It's a good thing at the beginning.
If we could slow down time in the middle of the shame spasm and think and consider our reactions, we'd be in much better condition.
Right.
Our everything is happening so fast.
Yeah.
And our first impulse, which is never good,
is
we don't make good judgments.
Right. There's an amygdala that's hijacked that really is faster than the cortex.
Train ourselves, it gets less and less. We also, I'm taking something that's totally not in the thing, to not eat before you make a bracha.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we say, well, people, some, you know, it's ingrained, you practice it, you learn it, you don't wake up one day and you say, from now on, no matter what's going to happen, I'm going to this. And then if you forget what you do, like you said, consciously think that becomes sometimes automatic, so that will be our first, our first reflex. Then come, okay, kavana, and like all those things that I'm saying. Like, people forget, like, when you learn how to walk, you have to practice walking. It's not like you read a book, you learn, and then that's it. You continue practicing, and then it becomes automatic.
Right.
Until it doesn't for some people, and that's already another.
Right. But to whatever extent we are able to get through this questionnaire here about, like, just noticing, becoming aware of how shame circulates through the body, through the psyche, that information is very useful in terms of, first of all, it creates, whoops, I just happened.
Where does it matter if your head or your arm or your stomach?
Because it's like a witness.
Who's there?
No, well, it's also that, but no, it's more like the detachment that comes from just witnessing yourself and what's happening there, and that it's not ruling you anymore. It's like you are kind of become the master of it rather than it mastering you. What page are we on again?
It's like tapping into your body, like a trauma tool is like a grounding technique.
Yeah.
So it would be a good force to like go from a dissociative state to like acknowledge your body in the present when you're like so dissociated.
It's yes.
Like, when you feel shame, that first instinct is like...
What's the grounding technique?
So someone that's experiencing trauma, they're like in a dissociative state where their body, they detach from what's happening because they can't handle the overwhelming effect.
But it's very subtle sometimes, and that's something important to know about dissociating. It has all levels, and to be aware even of this loss. Usually, when someone gets you upset, you dissociate a little less than when someone gets run over by a car, let's say, and is laying in the street. I hope. No, why am I saying that? Because when you don't, that's already something that you need to look into deeper. That if a person gets so dissociated, if someone insults them, then the level is different.
What were you saying?
So a grounding technique would be like just stomping your feet, let's say on the ground, experiencing the wind around you, like, and you become really, you force yourself present. Like a grounding technique would be a walking meditation. So you notice just colors. I'm just looking at colors. I see colors. It forces you into the present when your brain is like not here.
And into your body.
Yeah, and into your body. Like when you enter your body, holding something like your necklace, let's say, just holding it in your hand and experiencing it in the now brings you present when you're like not present. So people, sometimes some people self-mutilate as a way of helping you become
More in the body, like to feel.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so these things are ways of coming aware, you know, and then that way you're not just the shame.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because we can get to that point where we think that's just what we are, you know, that reaction. So like they're getting, is that?
Yeah.
But like I'm also wondering, because I had an ashamed stuff, and then I wish that I had been wearing sacrum before it happened. I haven't looked at the sacrum.
For the next.
Because it was ashamed stuff, but what I tried to look at afterwards is what in that event brought on the shame stuff. Isn't mm-hmm. it also like
you're
self-reflection, what are your triggers that lead you?
Sure.
Right. We're going to talk this
guy. Oh, we're going to get into that. Okay.
What's at the root of it, you're saying? Right?
Because everybody has their...
So someone insults you, but there's something about what they said that gets you. Yeah, I mean, in order for it to be a shame spasm, yeah. But it's, you know, not everyone would necessarily react in a shame spasm. That is spasm.
How long,
right?
Mm-hmm. How long does a shame spasm last? Minutes, hours, days, weeks? Does it vary depending on who, when, where? Does it leave a residue? Do I carry traces of grudge, resentment, insecurity, or fear even after I've resolved to move on?
Right. Who it is does make a difference. It says it to you. Yeah, well, that's the question. Does it have a difference? Like, does it really go, or am I a grudge keeper? Like, do I keep hold of grudge? Like, there's two, halachic isurim, like, of holding a grudge and kind of seeking revenge. And it's not so simple. It's really human nature to hold a grudge. Like, someone hurts you and you resent them and we talked about last week, you kind of hope that they, or not necessarily hope, but kind of smile when it comes back around to them, and they, which is revenge, basically, you know, like kind of enjoying their,
misfortune.
Deserve, you say, misfortune.
Isn't it more difficult, though, when you don't blame them, you blame yourself, you realize that what they said was right, it was a flaw on your part, and then it doesn't go away.
That's a different kind of situation, but it could go away. I mean, it's not, that's the whole point, is that if it doesn't go away, then there's something wrong in the way that you're processing shame.
Exploring these questions holds us into witness mode, which creates distance between us and the shame state itself. Patterns will emerge over time. That should help to manage the symptoms even if we can't address the cause in the moment.
Uh-huh. Right. Right. So, as I was saying, that part of the question, you know, the stepping back and asking ourselves these questions is because the information itself is useful, but also part of it is just the posture, the inner posture of, you have to be a little bit detached in order to be able to witness. And so, on one hand, is that problematical or is it not? Is it essential to really being able to process? Right? But to process non-reactively. That's the aim.
The more a person has their ego. What do we call it? Their
established ego, the minute.
Narcissistic supply.
Narcissistic supply. The more I would rather call it self-esteem.
Uh-huh.
That is up your tank of self-esteem.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
The more full that is, the more able a person is to detach and say, oh, she's coloring all over, this little kid is coloring all over my wall. Oh, that's interesting, but I'm not going to slap them in the face.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
It's an inverse proportion.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
I think that's true, 100%. The more self-esteem you have, the more you can handle it.
Uh huh.
No? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but there's always exceptions. But yeah.
What else can help you with that same reaction?
Yeah.
I mean, you've been talking about that, like, after I have this shame spasm, I get a shame reaction. Like, I feel, like you said, like, one of the reasons why we're trying to get good at this is because we don't want to have that after a fact, but, like, I'm really, yuck, I feel terrible about myself. So the more you fill up your tank also, it's kind of worth saying, you know, have also good things, good feeling about yourself, and like that you're not, you know, not to put yourself on that shit.
The more self-esteem you have, so you made a mistake, okay. But the less self-esteem you have, oh yeah, but I never did.
No, bad person, everybody's going
to
hate
you. You're
going
to just go on to, that's fine. Yeah.
Doesn't that depend where shame comes from? One is that you did something wrong. Or
we're going to go, we're
going to. To just sit and watch how our ego squirms from shame. The practice and the challenge is to not interfere, just observe. There is much to learn.
Right. I mean, there's, in other words, you can't always make it better. You
right.
can't always just, it's not, there's no tricks to just relieving the shame. And it could be that you just sit and breathe and watch.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of, you know, humorously see how your ego squirms. Like it just is doing whatever it can do to try to find someone else to blame. And
just call a friend to Godhead.
Right.
It's possible. Step away and collect yourself. Unfortunately, that option is not always available. As when we are in the middle of a board meeting or a Thanksgiving dinner. People regress and it just escalates.
Right. And sometimes you just have to, it says, the Talmud says that they do a test of who's from the highest, like, birth lineage.
Mm.
And it's it's whoever is quiet first, who stops talking first in an argument.
Huh.
And so sometimes you just have to, you're at the Shabbos or the Thanksgiving dinner table or whatever, and, you know, you just have to, stop. You don't get the last word. You have to acknowledge, allow someone else to get the last word.
I think it's when people who have Shabbos, those in this program, we have a lot more practice. We're talking here, Thanksgiving is a once-a-year thing that people prepare for. Because that whole setup of sitting around the table in the family is not practice.
Uh-huh.
So much. Right. So that's even more.
Uh-huh. Right.
In some situations, it might be possible to say something like, I can feel that I've been triggered, which means that it won't be productive to continue the conversation right now. I won't be able to take in what you're saying, and I won't be able to express myself properly either. Let's pause and continue in a few hours or tomorrow when I am calmer.
Right. So that's, you know, an ideal. There has to be a certain amount of trust and familiarity between the parties to be able to say that and have it be respected. But.
Or at least say it in yourself if the other person you don't have that level with. I wish I had all those lines, like, you know, my food is about to burn. Or, oh my gosh, I have to go right now. I didn't realize. Can we continue this later? I'm not usually so smooth like that.
Is it shameful to say, like, oh, I'll take that in consideration? Thank you. Like, thank you for telling me. I'll take that in consideration.
Yeah,
I think that's great.
You're
not even like, there might be truth in
it. Yeah. I think that's the most stressful
thing there is.
Often, Revitin Heller Gottlieb once said to once one of her things, if someone says something to you that is upsetting, or the first thing you have to do is check if it's true or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's true, then you have to change something. If not, you're allowed to say for that second that person is wrong. And then she said in her voice, and then you move on.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a split second here that we check it. And then if not, we're allowed to say that person is wrong.
But in the shame spasm, you're not going to be able to see that what they said is true, and you're just so busy projecting onto them.
Yeah.
And, right. Yeah. I mean, so it sounds like all of these things, they sound good on paper, but when you're burning from a shame spasm, it's very hard to remember what works, yeah.
If it's the other person who's been triggered, he or she might get defensive if that's pointed out. So in that case, it's best to ascribe the triggering to ourselves to say that we are the ones who need the time out, even though it's really for their sake. That's interesting. I can't handle this right now.
Someone said something that we were doing something together, and we have different views on how it should go, because that came up it doesn't work for other people. And I said, okay, I'll take that in consideration. Like, I paused. I'll take that in consideration. I said it, like, you know, and then we continued talking about it. Anyhow, I walked away, like, I heard underneath it, like, what was happening for them, that they felt like they were not getting heard, and it really had nothing to do with other people necessarily. So maybe we should just ask them what they want, and then we can do what they want, and which diminished how she's feeling, because she didn't tell me it was about her, she said it was everyone else. And then I went home, I texted the farmer, I said, hey, do you have 2 minutes to talk? She said, yeah, she called me back. And she pointed out what was happening for me inside of it, that it really, like, what I heard underneath it was someone trying to control me. Like, I don't like the way you're doing it, so stop. And I was like, no, actually, it works just fine. Like, maybe, like, we'll ask everyone else, but this is what I know, and this is how it was something specific that we were doing together, like, a thing that we were running together. And like I said to them in the moment, like, oh, I'll take that in consideration, like what you're saying, and we can bring you back. Well, I'll take that in consideration, because it wasn't like purposeful. Then I spoke to the friend who helped me see some stuff that had nothing to do with this other person, but more about myself, what was happening, which was really a shame spasm that was happening, because my defensiveness came up for me first, but my reaction was to say something in that moment. Like, she's another human being who's clearly having something happening for her, and then table it, like, and how to respond. Like, her facial reaction when I said, oh, I'll take that in consideration, I read into that as,
you were just blowing your own.
Yeah. And that wasn't what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I was reacting to my shame spasm by trying to, like,
which is a good thing to do.
Really tried, and I think I come off as condescending, saying it's going to be kind of abrupt sometimes. And so I think, like, it wasn't combative. I was like, I need, my brain was almost like firing like life support. Like, you need like an SOS. Like, and so
like, you were doing something, your idea wasn't considered, and then she felt like, and you said, I'll consider it, basically say, I'm not really going to consider it, but I'm going to tell you that. But you were doing that because you weren't considered, and you just didn't want to have a reaction.
There are contagious.
What?
The shame spasms are contagious.
Reacting off each other. And what I was able to do in that short conversation that we had was also say to her, like, why don't we bring this up to other people? And then she said something low. And then I said, do you feel like you're not being heard in this? And she kind of, like, stuttered a little bit over it and was like, well, it's both. And, like, other people, their needs. And I was like, then my brain went, oh, she's not feeling heard. Like, I have a different style than she does when we're doing this together, like co-leading something, that we have different styles. I'm very, like, I could be a little bit, I'm just confident in it, and, like, a little bit more assertive, and, like, very knowledgeable about it, so it's easy for me to talk, and for her, she has a different process. So it was, and it works for her, and I'm cool with, like, different voices, different flavors, great, more people internalize things differently, no problem. And so, like, obviously, it's a later conversation, not a now thing, but noticing what happened for me was really, I got triggered by, like, shut up, get smaller. You're not working, this is not working, you're doing wrong, you're doing bad. Like, because she blames in other people, like, as opposed to just saying, hey, it's not working for me. But, like, you can't control how other people communicate. And that would also cause her to have to do her process of saying, I'm feeling comfortable and I'm not feeling hurt. Let's say that's what's happening for her. Let's say. Mm-hmm. That would be a lot of like introspection in a moment to be able to say that when she could have been triggered by something that happened, maybe feeling like, oh, I, you know. And for me, it was like, oh, thanks for telling. If someone mm-hmm. said to me, hey, I feel like I'm not being hurt, I'd be like, thanks so much for telling me. Yeah. Hey, how can we work that?
Yeah.
But the way she came at it was the way in which I got triggered. And it was like,
right.
But I went home, talked to this friend who was like, hey, here's this, let's look at this and back this a little bit. And then kind of like, oh, and then maybe Cora and I can sit and talk next week. Prior to the next meeting. Mm-hmm. And then deal with it with
Kate. And also because of the way you dealt with it, you didn't create, like, you know, this big fire. Like, it was just comfort. But then now you can go back because, you know, you're
not you can spoil the relationship.
Right. You can go back.
And myself, if I read the process of like, which is a judgment of why can't she be, communicate more effectively? Why did she attack me? Because in my brain, that's how I feel, it was attacked. Why? And like, it's really my ego that was affected by all of it. If I get out of my own way, I could be, see her as a person just trying to communicate and being loving and compassionate. Because how many times have I tried to communicate something and then what is that in a certain form way? Because that's actually how I communicate a lot of times. So, like, being able to tap into compassion would probably help me a lot.
Beautiful. And it sounds like you're doing a lot of work.
Tremendous.
A lot of work.
It's so uncomfortable. And I'm like, I'm still in it. So
I know. But in that first category of changing the attitude, like, there's so much learning that happens in the kind of untangling a shame spasm and a contagious shame spasm. It's really there's a lot of inner work that happens in that, and that's
so cool.
Yeah, and so that's, you know, that's the good side of shame, the upside of shame.
Yeah.
I mean, it's shame. You know, where you you're not alone, that's for sure.
So you're not
going on?
Yeah.
Okay. Whatever happens, remember Brene Brown's 3 T's. Don't text, don't type, don't talk.
Really, I mean, it's so important.
In the midst of a shame spasm, a psyche regresses into a state that Cabal calls molten depression, narrow, constricted, childish consciousness. It is 99% certain that whatever we say or convey while possessed by Mohan to cutness, we are bound to regret it when our nervous system relaxes and returns to itself.
That is really true. It is really true. Like, that's also, even in your story, like, you held back of saying certain things. Did I hear that right?
With
her.
No, if it was with her, I wasn't reactive. Like, I wasn't...
But, so you didn't. You held back from saying things.
Felt it.
Right.
And her reaction was also
she felt the vibe.
But I think also she was reacting to what I was saying, even though I was like, okay, I'll take that into consideration. Her internal response may have been, not making an assumption, may have been being dismissed. And so she, and then seeing that on her, being like, wait, something else is going on here, what's going on? Like, your brain works so fast
right.
at the moment. But I think,
but you didn't say anything that really was going to permanently spoil the
attitude. Last night, she pushed me, and I went almost Brooklyn on her, and I didn't.
Okay.
Yeah, she didn't like that I was moving a chair, and she was in our space, my friend's space, and didn't like that I was moving a chair over, and then walked into my face, and then I was like, oh, make her go away. Like, just like, make her go away. And I was just like huffed up, kind of, and then she was like away from her because I knew like it was not gonna go good. I was like, they're gonna have to break us up. Wow, am I really heavy? And I didn't anything beyond. I was like, okay, I'm just gonna like stay with me in that corner. But the shame of like the initial like literally, hi, you're gonna have a fight with someone, like really, yeah, really, Brooklyn. Like I was like, there was shame that I experienced from my emotional response, not even if it came out. Like, there's shame in how you feel without just the human response. Like, why didn't I, let's say someone's about to, you know, attack you and a friend, and you hide behind your friend, like, have that happen? It's response. And then I felt shame, like, wait, so that meant that I was putting my friend in danger by hiding behind my friend, and then feeling shame. like, you know, human response, but
no.
You don't live up to your expectations.
Definitely high expectations, being perfect. Okay.
I've never heard that phrase, Pool of Brooklyn.
Oh, is it?
Where are you from?
Let me tell you something.
Are you from Brooklyn?
Yeah,
but I'm not from Brooklyn.
Pool of Brooklyn?
Pool of Brooklyn?
Yeah, I've been putting my earrings and, like, bite her. She's always like, she's like,
I have a friend from Brooklyn. She always says that. I'm from Brooklyn. What do you want? Like, they have this thing, and I'm like, I grew up here most of my life. And, like, every time she says it, I'm like, what? This type of thing.
Still, especially here.
So where are we?
We're on hurtful words. This is also hurtful words.
Yeah.
Once. Yeah. Hurtful words, once spoken, leave their impression even when both people know that the speaker was seized by a shame spasm and was effectively, quote-unquote, out of their mind. Still, those cutting words, even though the one who spoke them didn't mean them, can destroy a relationship forever, wreck an entire family, or create a multi-generational feud. And that is, I've seen that happen. I mean, it just is where the words that were spoken were just angry words. They were so totally not what that person really feels about the other person. But once they're stated, then they burn into the nerve net, and they can destroy not just a relationship, but whole family system.
I hate you.
Right. Yeah, right.
You know, I have a sister older than me, 2 years older, and she's also a psychologist. She was in a different field. But we were having a disagreement over something, and I was right.
Mm-hmm.
And she told it to me. No, of course. And I was, and I got very, very upset, and it was legit. So she said to me, in her quiet voice, that's very thoughtful, she said, I want you to think about if it's worth it for you to say what you're thinking, even if you're right,
mm-hmm.
because you can't take it back after it comes out.
Mm-hmm. Whoa.
She nipped it in the bud.
She
How important is it to be right, or is it more important to maybe not show up?
I remember seeing on the Thoughties wall, like, would you rather be right, or would you rather, you know, have a connect, you know, be...
I mean, it is just shocking how much damage you can do with a single sentence.
It's funny, we have this cute thing in our family, like, when we say something, like, thinking that we're right, and then we find out the other person's right, we give them a bracha. Baruch Yanu, Zadeo Baba. Brings a long life in this world and in the next. And we, the other person, wait. Like, you know, where's my Laurel coming?
Here was the epitome of, it was not a philosophical argument. I definitely was hurt by someone who said something in the room. And then that person left. It wasn't like that it didn't happen and it wasn't a problem. It did happen and there was nothing that I said right. Not right in the way that she saved me, my sister, from saying
things that you were, you were the wrong one, you were the wrong one.
Right.
Right. Brene Brown. Yeah.
Okay, so don't type, don't text. Don't talk.
And when you're in mulking to continuity, if you're in a shame spasm, you might feel like you know what's going on, but you're in mulking to continuity, and you're going to just cause trouble. It's going to backfire. Whatever you do, you're going to regret it.
Wait until you have quieted down and processed the matter, ideally with a confidant or a therapist, or even just through honest journaling.
Journaling would be that you go through the thing and try and put down what you understand.
Like, what just happened here? And what was I thinking? What were they thinking? Is there any truth to what they were thinking, what they were saying that I couldn't admit at the time? And also, it's really important to be honest with yourself. Like, That's,
to be a witness.
Like a husband at
Yeah.
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 So can I just say something on that? Like I had something happen with somebody before Rosh Hashanah, and it's usually easy for me to get the other person's side to see where I was off.
Uh-huh.
And I had so much on that, and I got together with them. I wanted to make sure to get there and to mochel me before Yom Kippur, which they did, but they didn't really want the same level of friendship. They didn't feel trust, but
as a result of what transpired.
Mm-hmm. And then I did more work and I realized, you know, I have a side too. And I got together with them again. I said, I just want you to know, I need to get together with you. I totally get your side. I feel for you. I understand what's going on for you. You know, there was also mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to share that mm-hmm. with you. Mm-hmm. That was like a first for me, because that's mm-hmm. the whole life carried this thing of, I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. I get where I was off. Yes, I need to say I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Like, but to actually kind of come out with this, like I had a different kind of a shame, like the shame towards, hey, you know, mm-hmm. I have a side of my own kind of
side
here.
And how does it affect the relationship?
Yeah, did it affect the relationship?
You know, it's hard to say. This person, I understand where they're at. Their trust was really impacted on, you know. Clearly there's a lot before me, because whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just saying, I understand them. I don't know if I'll ever really have, like, we were kind of a new friendship also. It's not mm-hmm. like, you know, the time you can kind of fix things with people you got a long history with, maybe sometimes easier. But I just felt so good. Mm-hmm. It was something.
Yeah, you stood up for yourself.
Mm-hmm. And then I was really real. I wasn't laying anything. I'm just like, I don't know, it's kind of like being my own mommy. Like, it was very, very healthy for me, because I'm very good at, like, I kind of get the sense from what you're saying, you know, but I was wrong here. How am I supposed to get out of that? Like, I've lived with that a lot. You know, like, to be able to say, okay, I'm human, I'm working on myself, and there's also a side that had its own, you know, to this. Like, it wasn't just I did the wrong.
Uh-huh.
It was
right.
something that led to it.
You know?
Right.
It was very... This new.
It's so interesting.
Yes.
It's like a real operation. Sometimes I go to like a lot of times people either go to blaming others or blaming themselves. It's like the balance is the so important part, is to be able to see like where was I actually wrong and where had I wronged. And like to see that in an honest, in the same time.
Right, I mean, there is a desperate need to blame someone else. Like, that's one of the characterizing features of a shame spasm, is just the...
blame yourself or blame others.
Yeah.
I think there's a what motivated the thing that I did wrong? That's what I'm thinking. Why did I do that? No, now, in retrospect, it was wrong. What pushed me to do that? Why couldn't I see it at the time?
Mm-hmm.
So
I think
there's something
to speak there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so who's up?
No.
Once you're able to.
I'm able to reflect on the incident, it's good to explore the question. Where does it hurt? Shame inevitably traces back to an ego wound, whatever the present story may be. Underneath it all, there's some kind of ego distress that's producing the shame. The discomfort could be perfectly legitimate or overly reactive, or all points in between. It's very helpful to get to the bottom of it, yet it's also very delicate work. It takes honesty, persistence, and vulnerability to face your shame. This is difficult, even when no one else is listening. Just speaking your shame out loud or writing it down can be challenging for the ego.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That is true.
So if you journal it, you face it.
It is, I mean, ideally that's the point of journaling, but, you know, it's not necessarily foolproof. Because
you can put your body at ease.
Uh-huh.
I suppose you use this as a fact to beat yourself up with.
Right, or someone else. Yeah, or beat someone else up.
Yeah.
An example of how this might work through self-reflective journaling and the questions one might ask. are you dealing with the shame of failure, defect, or insult? Or perhaps...
Right, so wait, so it's saying, because there are three things that cause, that are generally cause shame, failure, defect, and insult. So which, is there, can you identify, is it one or another of those that's kind of, that your present spasm is reacting to? Sometimes they're all there, sometimes you can identify one, sometimes there's one that's a foreground and one that's a background, but the point of identifying where the source of that shame is coming from, failure, defect, or insult, is that you deal, the advice, the Talmudic advice, is to deal with each one of those types of shame differently. And so you, once you identify, is it failure, is it defect, is it insult, it'll give you some clues and guidance about what to do in order to process it in the most spiritually productive way. And those failure, defect and insult are discussed earlier on in the book in terms of, So there's like a chapter on each of them.
What? How you react to, you respond to different times of shame differently.
Yes.
Yes. Again, we talked about this. Okay.
Or perhaps some combination of all three. It's good to identify the primary source of shame for each of these instigators. Is passive indifference in a different way. The shame of failure is productive and, in the right measure, prompts a tshuva process that ends with net gain. The shame of the defect is not productive. It is doing oneself to other people's judging harm. The shame of insults requires that we soothe the ego and, for the most part, accept the humbling incidents without nursing a grudge or exacting revenge.
So I think we're done. I think this is just a... Wait, is there a last... I think the last paragraph there. It's the present shame.
Is the present shame chronic or acute? Is it shame over the way you've lived your life and the global decisions that brought you to this shame-triggering circumstance that is chronic? Or is it shame over a particular incident that is acute? It is likely to be some combination of both, one being the foreground and the other being the background.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't think so. It's long. It's long.
Usually, though, if you have a really strong pain spasm, there's got to be fast around there.
Generally.
If it's hysterical, it's historical.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I never heard that.
Makes sense.
What was I just going to say?
Yeah.
The most... Insult is the most difficult shame to really process.
If you are like, what happened was that in that case, the surrogate, the shame of failure, like I thought I was doing a good job, she's saying I'm not doing a good job, being insulted, like it was also that it was said in front of a few other people. So there were like a few things that were happening simultaneously. Ooh, I'm actually giving breath for a moment. So there was a few things that that's like compounded.
So other people were there too, though.
Yeah, there's one other person and she's like, I'm going to take my kid and go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, did not call her after to talk to her because she,
everyone's in a gym.
Why are you going to take their kid and go?
Well, we were there and she left. Like, she was like, I'm just going to get